December 20th, 2025, beginning of winter. So starting in a few days, the days only get longer from here till summer solstice and so on, these cycles. And one thing that's probably a good hallmark or a testament to our practice is learning how to respond skillfully when we make mistakes. The judge of our practice is not to be if we never make mistakes, but it's how do we respond when we make mistakes, and how do we keep moving forward. So when we do something, we do some sort of action that we can't undo, and then we regret it, or we say something that we can't undo and then we regret it, then how do we move forward from that? So the way to gauge our practice is not by if we never fail or if we never make mistakes, but it's how do we keep moving forward when we do fail, when we do make mistakes. So the word that we have for like when the monks commit an infraction of the Vinaya rules, say when a bhikkhu breaks or has an infraction of one of the 227 training rules, then that's called apati, which literally means to fall down. And then when you fall down, then your fellows in the holy life help to pick you back up. So that's how we train. And then there's this image that Ajahn Mahabua gives of what the path of practice looks like. And it's like someone who's just at first, you know, running, maybe excited about the practice and running. Yeah, Nibbana. And running toward Nibbana, and then boom, fall on your face, fall flat on your face. And then the person gets back up and they're kind of walking, staggering, slightly injured, fall over again. They're crawling for a little while. And there's times when they're getting dragged through the gravel. And then they kind of get up and run for a bit again, and then fall flat on their face again, and then get up and walk. And that's really how it is. So it's not going to be smooth sailing all the time. Or one of our friends had a bumper sticker on his truck: here we do walk our dreams, we just walk them with a limp. So that this isn't an ideal condition. Yes, we do want to succeed and we will succeed, but maybe not in the way that we originally envisioned. And it won't necessarily be what we originally thought, and it can't be. So to allow things to unfold in a very natural way. I was in Thailand, it's 2011, actually. Ajahn Mahabua just passed away, and myself and another monk had the opportunity to go and pay respects to his body after he passed away and before his cremation. And I thought, you know, we should probably go and see other disciples of Ajahn Mun who haven't passed away yet, just to take that opportunity because there's not much time. And there was a very old monk named Lungpu Jam who was living in Mukdahan. And so we went to see him, pay respects to him. He was 103 at the time, and he has since passed away. And then we went to pay respects to another monk named Lungpu Sang, who I believe is also possibly just passed away at the age of 100. And he must have passed away a few years ago at the age of 100. And when we paid respects to him, he was 88. And I remember we didn't have much conversation with Lungpu Jam because he was deaf, but with the Lungpu Sang, then my Thai was just good enough at that time to be able to have some conversation with him. And he asked us how our practice was going and asked us if we were doing the Asubha practice, the recollection of the unattractive nature of the body, and then asked us if we would stay ordained or if we wanted to disrobe. So we had some brief conversation like that. And then he's a Dhammayut Ajahn. So technically in the Ajahn Chah tradition, we're Mahanikai. But Ajahn Chah is recognized as good by the Dhamma Utes. And Ajahn Mun himself was a Dhamma Ute monk who told Ajahn Chah that he shouldn't change his ordination lineage because Mahanikai needs good monks too. And so Lhunpo was saying, oh yeah, Ajahn Paniwado, good Western student of Ajahn Mahabua. Very, very good. Very, very good. Very good. Oh yeah, Ajahn Sumedho. Good, good, good. Very good. Yeah, Ajahn Sumedho is really good. Yeah, those are two Western monks that are really good. Ajahn Sumedho, Ajahn Paniwado. And he said, you know, a lot of you Westerners don't realize that, you know, you have somebody like Ajahn Sumedho and, you know, you don't realize maybe what you have or how good he is, because a lot of times the Westerners, he said, he noticed that the Western monks tend to look at the externals too much and that the internal is more hidden. So you might look at somebody like Ajahn Sumedho and say, oh, well, you know, he's this way or that way. And we might judge him according to our own tendencies and think, well, you know, someone who's liberated from suffering must be like this or must be like that. And so the teaching from this Ajahn Lhunpo Sang was like, you guys don't realize what you have. You have good teachers already, but they don't match your preconceived ideas of what a Krupa Ajahn should be. Therefore, you don't recognize them. You don't realize what you have. So I thought that always stuck with me. It's a very good teaching. And when we recollect, we can be very unassuming and think, well, we don't know. We don't know. We can't say necessarily based on our own judgments who is where in their practice. But what we can do is we can see our own judging critical mind. And I spoke about that yesterday as well, that we live in a judgmental critical society. This is just natural that we'll have a judgmental critical mind. And that even, I'll mention this again just to remind people that even Santa Claus is judging us. He's saying, this person's good, this person's bad. You know, this person gets presents in their stocking, this person gets coal in their stocking. And I don't know if Santa Claus is that great, actually. Not cool. And he's kind of enslaved an entire race of elves. So, I'm not gonna go into Santa Claus too much, just to say that maybe not a cool dude. But yeah, with our own teachers, we don't know. We shouldn't necessarily get into this judgmental, critical attitude. Something good to remember as well is a way to gauge our practice is to see what the mind defaults to. So when we're distracted, not necessarily when we're meditating, but when we're distracted, when we're in the midst of activity, what does the mind default to? And these are teachings that Lhunpo Liem in past visits here, he's given to us. And again, these things that have stuck out for me is this one teaching where it was a teaching Lhunpo Liem gave when he visited in 2004, when he helped to consecrate the Dhammacakka Buddha image at the ordination platform. And we had pujas up there at the time. We would have morning and evening pujas sometimes up there. And we would sometimes do our Visakha puja or even Asala puja up there in May and July, respectively. And I just remember this teaching because I contemplated it so much over the years that when we experience feeling, everything is feeling. And that's probably Lhunpo Liem's favorite word is kwam rusa, which means feeling in Thai. And everything is rusa, everything is feeling. And there's pleasant feeling, painful feeling, and neutral feeling. And when we experience pleasant feeling, there's a default reaction of the mind to go into attachment to it. And when we experience unpleasant feeling, there's a default reaction in the mind to go into aversion to it. When we experience neutral feeling, there's a default reaction to go into confusion or wanting it to be some other way, wanting it to be pleasant or unpleasant, wanting it to be otherwise. So that can be delusion. That could be defined as delusion. And so when we experience these feelings, we have these default reactions to them, rather than seeing it just feeling as feeling, then there's this automatic reaction. And then that's our life. And our life is just feeling. It's very simple. But then the mind, the thoughts pick it up and we think it's more than that. And really all that's happening is just feeling, feeling, craving, perception, feeling, craving, perception. But then at the same time, we have to look after ourselves. We have to nourish ourselves. We have to keep our life going. So that's where the contemplation of the requisites comes in. That's where we learn how to have mindfulness of feeling and how do we call into question those default reactions and not be a slave to feeling, not be a slave to those reactions. And then we can extend this out to all sorts of other teachings. So I'm going to quote Longpa Liem again from his most recent visit. And he talked about love and hate. And the teaching that stuck out for me on his most recent visit, just earlier this year, was that you have to be careful when you love somebody because there is a great danger in that. And the danger is that in that occurs when we don't have Dhamma and we don't have mindfulness around what we're experiencing. So when we love somebody, then however much we love them, then if that person then does something that we really dislike or disagree with, then we will hate them to the same level that we loved them. And that's the danger. So there's gratification in that, and that love is wonderful. The danger is if the person we love does something that's we really disagree with or that really we really dislike, then the love will turn into hate to the same level. That's the danger. And the escape would be then insight into it, knowing that that can happen and saying, okay, well, maybe the clinging to this love is not as great as I thought it was. So to cool it off, to relinquish it, because there is always going to be that danger there. If we're clinging to love, then hate is right there. So that's Dhamma. We have to be very, very careful of that. If we're able to see that, if we're able to be mindful, it's not a problem. So we have these default reactions to feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And we could say pleasant is attachment, unpleasant is aversion, neutral is delusion. Those are the worldly reactions to feeling. And then the Dhamma reaction is mindfulness. So we're able to have sati in a sense of sampajanya, recollection, clear knowing, clear awareness around these things, then we aren't necessarily bound up in those reactions. And then this goes into Kanti Parami in Thai. Again, we say otton, which means to patiently endure. Literally means to, ot means to go without, ton means to endure. So be willing to go without, be willing to endure. One possible translation of that is the ability to be with the unpleasant. The ability to bear with the unpleasant, not necessarily the gritting our teeth and hoping for it to end, but to just to bear with it, just to be able to be present for it and to be with it without the hope that it's going to end. That's Kanti. That's what we call patient endurance. And that is a quality we develop that can overcome and burn up all sorts of mental obscurations, all sorts of defilements. The patient person can always be content, always be happy, even in the midst of pain. So let us come back to that, you know, cultivation of patience. Patience as deep as the ocean, deep and profound patience. That's going to be a necessary quality to carry us forward in the practice. And that's going to be a necessary quality to carry us forward when we make mistakes. It's going to be a necessary quality to carry us forward when we have those inevitable failures, when we fall down, when we apati, when we fall down, to be able to pick ourselves back up or allow ourselves to be picked back up, and then to dust ourselves off and keep going. I'll offer that for reflection this evening.